then the shanty boy comes down, in his pockets 50 pounds. He will look around some pretty girl to find, if he finds her not too shy, with a dark and rolling eye. Then the shanty boy is well pleased in his mind. So the landlady comes in, she is neat and very trim. She is like the evening star. If she finds him in good trim, she is always ready to wait on him. And from 1 to 2 they'll sit up on the bar. So the shanty boy goes on till his money is all gone, and the landlady she begins to fret. Oh, he says, my lady, do not fret, I will pay my honest debt, and bid adieu to the girl we left in town. Back to the woods he'll go with his heart so full of woe, and he'll wander round from tree unto tree till 6 months have gone and passed. All his cares have gone at last. It is time for him to go upon a spree. There's a crew that's in command, so the old folks understand. And it's to the darker woods where we must go, with a bottle and a song. We will shove the old canoe along and bid adieu to the girl we left in town. When the shanty boy comes down, in his pockets 50 pounds, he will look around some pretty girl to find, if he finds her not too shy, with a dark and rolling eye. And the shanty boy is well pleased in his mind.
Tuned in to 106.1 FM WSCA LP Portsmouth. We are Portsmouth Community Radio. Please note that the views expressed on this program are those of the individuals who speak them and not necessarily of Portsmouth Community Radio, its Board of Trustees, members, volunteers, or underwriters. Hey folks, it's time for Local Folk here on Portsmouth Community Radio. I'm your host, Steve Carrigan, and I'm bringing to you the people that make folk culture happen. And stay tuned for the music and stories of my guests who are here to share with you all a bit of their personal histories and musical selves. And I hope that you, my listeners, are inspired to action and decide to participate in one way or another in the folk community. FYI, one way you could do this is through the upcoming pledge drive. It's not here right now, but it's certainly coming up, and I'll have more details soon. But so keep that in mind. Before I introduce my guest this evening, I have a few announcements. I'm going to stop it right there because, well, we don't need to worry about tomorrow too much. I want to get on to my guest. Tonight's guest is a mentor to my mentor, And his folks are responsible for collecting a huge amount of source, quote-unquote, source folk music from all over the East Coast, from the Carolinas to New Hampshire. The torch was somehow passed to him to be the keeper, adapter, and especially the teacher of these works. I first knew him as a guy who my voice teacher, Bruce McIntyre, had performed with, and also as a guy that always seemed to have really cool sounding songs down at the press room. And that's where I really learned about folk music, was down at the press room. He'd walk in and he played these songs that I'd never heard, and everybody seemed to know, but they weren't performing. And I learned later on it's because they held him, I believe it's because they held him in such high esteem. Anyways, as I delved deeper into the different non-mainstream aspects of folk music, I came to realize the depth and breadth of the impact his family's collection has had on the folk music world. And now I know why people make room for him when he shows up at sessions. So I've made room for him here. And I am honored to have with me Jeff Warner. Jeff, thanks for being here.
Steve, thanks. I'm glad we started. I was getting mesmerized by your weather cast.
Well, it is amazing. The chance of rain, I mean, you know, who knows?
I was worried 40%? About tomorrow, and then you said, let's not worry about tomorrow.
Don't worry about it. I always think, just look out the window. I mean, I work outside, and I never even, you know, tomorrow I won't even remember what my weather forecast was. Well, hey, let's get to what's really important, actually, on this program. And I want you to tell the people who are listening, who don't know, more about why you and your family are so well-known and esteemed in the folk music world. It started with your folks. Please tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I just did a two-hour show on this that I've been working on for a couple of years. We did it down in Washington, D.C. for the Folk Society down there. So it's an interesting, not short, but how can we give the 50-cent version here?
50-cent version.
I'm a Greenwich Village kid born in the 40s of a Missouri mother and a North Carolina father. And my father was a singer, a good singer, but not necessarily a folk song. It's just a southerner. Came to New York. And they fell in with a literary community in the 30s and 40s there in Greenwich Village, who at the time of the Depression, of course, were looking to the common man to lift him up and to write about him. And I mean, The Grapes of Wrath is the prime example of that. But people were concerned with rural life and rural people and the sort of heroism of them. And so it was through writers and formal collectors of songs working for the Farm Security Administration and the Library of Congress, that my folks began to see the value of this music. Someone brought a lap dulcimer to my folks' house in 38, and they had never seen one. Nowadays, people know them, but in the 30s, they were almost unknown outside of the Appalachians. So my folks wrote to the old rural guy, Nathan Hicks, who had made this for the folk song collector who came to visit my father in New York, and said, would you make one for us? And they said they would, but they had no money. So they had my folks had to send the money down in advance, and then they made the fateful decision, my folks did, to drive down to get that instrument rather than have it mailed to them. And once they went way back there in Watauga County, North Carolina, and saw people living back there without electricity and without running water, hearing the old songs that they sang to keep their spirits up and for amusement, they said, whoa.
Now, were you alive then?
No.
Okay, so this is your folklore. I mean, this is what you know, but this is what you heard about growing up?
Yeah, exactly so. So I came up, and for me, I don't know, my father was just on stage. He was a YMCA director, so he didn't do this. He didn't do music full-time, but as a hobby and as a semi-pro, he was on stage all the time singing for folks, and I just sat there as a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old saying, maybe that's what fathers do, right? They just get up on stage and sing for people.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, very well. And then he had me up singing with him by the time I was 8. So, I loved cowboys, so the first thing he had me sing was, come along, boys, and listen to my tale. Tell you about my troubles on the old Chisholm Trail. Come a tie-eye, yippee-yippee-yay, yippee-yay. Come a tie-eye, yippee-yippee-yay. Anyway, so
they
were living in New York, and they continued to collect. The Second World War stopped them for a long time. They used a portable disc maker to cut records before tape.
Okay.
And then they started giving those songs to the Library of Congress. And in 1950, they got a tape recorder, which made all the difference because now they could do interviews with singers and they could take whole songs. But before, they were just taking fragments of songs to get the melodies.
Were you there when they were cutting the records?
Nope. No, I don't know that. That happened before I was born. And then by the time I'm sentient and realizing what's going on, it's in the 50s and they have tape.
Okay, so by the time you come into the program, your folks have been collecting music for quite a long time. They collected the song Whiskey in the Jar.
Well, right, yeah. And
Whole World in My Hands.
Whole World in His Hand, which my father was singing before it became widely known. He's got the whole world in his hand, he's got the whole world, which people still know to this day. But it wasn't only my father that introduced that, but Mahalia Jackson made it really, really popular.
Yeah.
It was bringing these things out so that people can hear them and then make them their own. The prime example is Tom Dooley, of course, because my folks heard that song from Frank Proffitt in Western North Carolina, sang it to Alan Lomax, who put it in a book, and the Kingston Trio picked it up in 58 and made 6 million copies of the Tom Dooley song, which was a real murder ballad and real murder story that happened in Western North Carolina.
I want to play at least a little bit of a song of your dad performing, because he recorded
yes,
a little bit.
Yes, right. Good idea. I mean, because talk about influences on my life. I want you to understand first that it's an unusual sound. My father got so intrigued by the rural people that he was hearing and trying to tell their story that he really tried to sound like them. And he really could, because of his growing up in the South, sing black music kind of like a black man. And that's the first cut that I wanted you to hear, was a little bit of this Asheville Junction, which is a work song for driving spikes when they're building the railroads in Western North Carolina.
Okay, I'm going to play
after the Civil War.
Track 16 right here.
Yes, please.
Asheville Junction. What? Swannanoa Tunnel. What? All kid and be. What? I'm going back to what? Swannanoa Tunnel. What? That's my home, babe. What? That's my home. What? Last December. What? Well, I remember how the wind blowed cold, babe. How the wind blowed cold. When you hear my watchdog howling, somebody round.
So that's your dad singing a song
about black culture.
And I want to play another song by him as well. But I have a question for you. Did you hear the song when you were growing up?
Yeah.
I mean, did you ever want to drive a railroad spike or anything like that? Was this inspiring to you?
No, I don't know. It was just part of the air I was breathing. This, a guy on stage or at a party singing the song, kind of wild and free and big.
Yeah.
I've gone back, had fantasies of doing that song. I can't come close to it. I haven't got the roots inside me of that black music to try that. Peter Bellamy was an English singer, right? He met my father for the first time at the Newport Folk Festival in 1967. And he approached my father and he said, "You, sir, are not Frank Warner. Frank Warner is an old black man," because he'd heard my father sing.
So he did a pretty good imitation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
adoption.
Adoption.
It, you know, restatement of it. But he was, my father was unafraid to jump right in there and sound like the rural people that he had met. Oh. And you'd hear it time and time again in his music. But I thought I would go back and play kind of before my father got into folk music, he was a singer of popular songs of the 20s and 30s.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is that what we have?
And that's what this is. This is up there. He's recording it when he's in his 70s. But
what number are we at here?
It's number 12.
Okay, I want to play with this just to contrast.
Yeah.
To contrast what was going on.
You'll hear
this is
kind of Bing Crosby in here now.
All right, here we go. I'm ready for it.
You can take me away from Dixie, but you can't take Dixie from me. You can take me away to the end of the world, but my Dixie ways will follow me. I got the South in my mouth while I'm talking. Swanee smiles on my face, you can see. I still say you all, and everyone knows. And nothing but cotton in my best suit of clothes. I get all my cheroots from Virginia, all my mail from Tennessee. Spend my cash on Southern hash, the only thing that pleases me. But take me way up north with the ice and snows. I want to be down south where the cotton grows. You can take me away from Dixie, but you can't take Dixie from me.
Is it, this is a black song as well?
Well, it is, but it's sort of, it's a pop song. Is the kind of thing that you would have heard in the 20s and 30s sung by white singers for white bands approximating black music.
Okay, so it was sort of, whereas the other one did sound a lot...
Straight rural black.
Straight rural. Now, I mean, but for the modern listener, they both sound like folk.
I ain't got no complaints with that. Yeah, especially with my father, just with a little tenor guitar. You know, he's not with a giant band in 1927.
Yeah, but you've mentioned twice that your recollection is of him on stage,
right? Yeah.
Whereas, but I mean, what do you think? You know, a lot of people would say that, you know, the folk, you know, the more folk it is, the less on stage it is. You know.
I deal with it every day. I deal with it every day. It's what I call the dichotomy of folk music and the stage. This old rural stuff was done by people for their own amusement and to keep their society going. As Mike Seeger said to me once, up until 100 years ago, if you ever heard a piece of music, it was performed by somebody in the same room as you, which for us is unthinkable. So this music was their only music. And then you try to take that, the song that was precious to you because your grandmother sang it to you, and put it up on stage in Town Hall in New York for 250, 800 people. How do you make that transition, right? I deal with that every day.
How do you make that transition?
Well, you try to be honest to the music. You try to do it. You try to keep the old singers in your head as you're restating and reinterpreting for the new audience. You know, you try to be honest to both of them. It is honest to the old music and understanding that it's the sounds of these rural people singing is not a sound that people in urban America are used to hearing. So you try to pull them together somehow.
You try to bring them to it, even though you're up on stage.
I was talking to you about... About 10 years ago, I came across a newspaper article. It was a review of a museum exhibit. And the writer said, you know, I don't go to museums to be entertained. I go to museums to find the latest news from the distant past. I thought, I'll have that, thank you. I wrote it right down. And because I really see that. I see this as it is something that can be important to today's people. It is something that can ring a bell about their childhood, or it can open up a feeling about their country to hear rural sounds like this. but they're not going to. It's going to be hard for them to go back and listen to archival recordings of a guy born in 1890, you know, and make sense of that.
I mean, it may be. It would probably be difficult for them to go to the Warner Collection and listen to some of these things and say, "Oh, this is really."
Well, they can do, because my brother and I brought out two albums of the Rural Singers, so they can go to hear it from.
But don't they have to go to the Smithsonian to
no,
hear
no,
it?
No, no, no. I brought it out for a couple of labels. They go to my website, jeffwarner.com, and you can see that two records, two albums that we brought out in about 2000 were of the first, the disc recordings that my parents made, and later the tape recordings that they made. So you can, if you want to, immerse yourselves in that old music and listen to the real people singing it that inspired me and my father and my mother and a whole generation of people who wanted to sound like the old singers.
New questions.
Which we should get into pretty soon.
Yeah, we should too. We can definitely get into it, but I do just have one more, another question.
It's your show.
For you.
You got it.
Did you rebel against your folks, or did you just go with what they were doing?
Great question. Because I came up in the 60s, folk music was popular as well. So what I was doing in high school and college was getting an audience, because that's the kind of sound people were hearing on their records, you know. So I never rejected it, both because I liked it and also because I was getting reinforced from outside. So no, I never rejected it.
Okay, so you luckily you were in a time and place in life where it was for where your parents were doing the cool thing. Your parents were the cool kids, and you knew about it.
Kinda, that's right.
Let's talk about this next song that you have.
Yeah. One of the key people that my folks met when they started looking for old songs was back there in Watauga County, North Carolina, Frank Prophet. I have a handmade banjo that he made for me before he died in 1965. And he's the one that introduced the song Tom Dooley. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley, hang down your head and cry. But I wanted you to hear him singing one of my favorite songs of his called Going Across the Mountain. Well, he's such a sensitive, true singer.
Okay, I'm going to play that for you right now, actually. This is
Going Across the Mountain.
Going Across the Mountain. Hold on just a moment. I'm having a slight technical issue right here. You better fill me in with something, because my CD player seems to have frozen for one. Let me give you one more question.
Yeah, sure.
At the same time that folk music was happening, rock music was happening, but were you just like, I don't want to have anything to do with that, or? What did you think about that stuff?
I mean, it's like a separate world. That's
were you
all.
Listening to it?
Yeah. I mean, I never was a giant fan, but, you know, I'd go to parties and Ray Charles was singing, and I'm, you know, out dancing and dancing away and having a great time. Had the connections there were not, I mean, which now I can look and see, maybe with Ray Charles especially, is the roots music moving from traditional rural black music into pop. I can see that now. But at the time, no. It was what my folks did, and then it was what was on the radio. And sometimes they crossed a little bit with the Brothers Four or the Kingston Trio or the Highwaymen or something like that, but mostly it didn't.
Was the Kingston Tom Dooley was who performed that?
The Kingston Trio.
The Kingston Trio performed that. Were they like the Ray Charles of the time, because they adapted it?
All right. That's valid. They adopted an old song and adapted it for new ears. The commercial sound of folk music in the 60s and 70s leading into Peter, Paul, and Mary and all that, I knew when I started hearing Peter, Paul, and Mary where that roots music was coming from, but it had changed so much to make it palatable to general audiences that it's confusing.
I think I'm about to play something that may not be very palatable at all to a modern audience. Let's see.
We'll see what comes out of that.
Okay, let's see what comes out of the box. It looks like it might be working now.
Going across the mountain, oh, fairly well. Going across the mountain. hear my banjo tale. I got my rations on my back, my powder hit is dry. Going across the mountain, Chrissy, don't you cry. Going across the mountain, oh, fare you well. Going across the mountain, oh, fare you well. Going across the mountain to join the boys in blue. When it's all well and done, then I'll come back to you. Going across the mountain, oh, fare you well. Going across the mountain. Across the mountain, if I have to crawl, to give old Jessamine a little taste of my life and all. Way before it's good daylight, nothing happens to me. I'll be way down yonder in old Tennessee. I'm going across the mountain, oh, fairly well. Gone, but I'm going through when this fighting's over and I'll come back.
You're tuned to 106.1 FM WSCA LP Portsmouth. We are Portsmouth Community Radio. You're listening to Local Folk. I'm your host, Steve Kerrigan, and I am with Jeff Warner today, who is there's just so much to talk about. Jeff, you're going to have to be, I'm going to have you on as a quarterly quarterly participant in my show if you ever would, because there's just too much, you know, there's just so much going on and there's so much to talk about. So we just have to say, hey, man, we ain't going to get to the whole world today, but, you know, we can get to some of it and try to explain a little bit. That last song that we were just playing was something that you said is the same person performing that was the person that performed Tom Dooley that became so popular, correct?
Right. Yeah, well, he learned the song from his Aunt Nancy Prather, did Frank Proffitt, who was born in 1913, by the way. So he learned it from his Aunt Nancy Prather, and he sang it to my father as a person who was interested in old songs of Beach Mountain, Watauga County. And my father then taught it to Alan Lomax, who put it in Folk Song USA in 1947, a book. And it worked its way around the country, and the Kingston Trio recorded it. It was 100 light years away, not only in place, but in sound, when the Kingston Trio recorded that, from the plaintive small banjo sound of Frank Proffitt that you just heard.
Very small banjo sound.
Right in your living room, right there with you. But earnest and heartfelt and straight.
Real?
And real, thank you.
Did you get this when you went to a coffee shop, when you went to a coffee house?
Yes, I will say yes. I was hearing this. I also was 20 and I wanted to be popular, so I was playing my guitar as best I could. We need to talk about the Harry Smith anthology and how important it was, and also about blues and black music, because when I was coming along, I was really interested in college was black music, you know, playing guitar, cool blues guitar. That's
cool
what I wanted to
guitar.
Do. Yeah. And it took me, I don't know, 10, 15 years to realize that wasn't really my métier. What I should be doing is, sure, some black music, but Anglo music, that's my roots music. You know,
that is your roots music.
My roots music, and I wasn't as, I couldn't interpret the black stuff, like my father could, who came out of the South. It wasn't what I was happiest interpreting. So I've moved away from that in my 20s and now doing much more sea music and Anglo music and Northeastern folk music and lumbering songs and stuff that comes out of the gold rushes and, you know, all historical music and great, but closer, I feel, to my own internal roots.
So in a way, you did rebel. I asked you if you did. You said you didn't, but really, you went off to try to sing blues music, which is a bit of a—I don't know if that's rebellion or not.
Yeah,
it might be.
It was the avenue that I of a tradition that I initially went down. So I wanted to play for you a little bit of this Blind Lemon Jefferson, who's came out of Texas in the 1920s and made an early recording, which I can then move into the Harry Smith anthology.
Yes, of course. And what track are we listening to?
Oh, that's on six on that one.
There's so many great CDs here. It's unbelievable. There's piles of them.
Only one kind, baby, I ask of you. What is one kind, baby, I ask of you. Lord, is one kind, baby, I ask of you. See, that's my greatest campaign. It's a long way, I know you. It's a long lane that's got no end. It's a long lane, ain't got no end. There's a bad wind that never
changes.
This is the blues.
Now, come on, man. How can that not move you? That is great stuff. Recorded in 1928. And Blind Lemon Jefferson was a Texas musician. I think he's influenced kind of all rock music from then on.
Oh, I
mean, I really, really believe it. So that caught me too. And a guy named Dave Van Ronk, who was playing in Greenwich Village at the time, a white guy doing really, really good black music. I thought that was just great. And a record came out on Elektra Records by a group from Minnesota, three white guys, Blues Rags and Holler. Blues Rags and Hollers, and I just, in 61, 62, I thought that's the best thing ever. And even Bob Dylan's first albums were, you know, straight. They had that feeling of real roots music to them.
They did.
You know, more than when he started going electric or he started writing his own stuff. He was writing his own stuff early on, but he was doing roots music, and it really moved me.
So is this the stuff that still turns you on?
It still turns me on.
Yeah, this is still the good stuff where you sit back and you put on the headphones or whatever it is and you go, ah. Really?
Take me back, honey. But where Blind Lemon Jefferson, where I picked this off of,
yes,
was an album called the Harry Smith Anthology. And
okay,
anyone who's interested in my generation in old-timey blues, roots, Appalachian music, it has to be aware of the Harry Smith Anthology. It came out in 1952. And what it was a collection reissued by a guy named Harry Smith who took 1920s and 30s commercial recordings,
okay,
of country people and brought it out a generation later. It had been the Depression had stopped the record companies from issuing rural music. And then the Depression hit, the Depression and the Second World War. And so now you're coming into the 50s and people had forgotten that music. Really, except unless you lived in southern Mississippi or, you know, went in western rural Texas, you'd forgotten that music. And he brought it out for people to hear. And it kind of changed all of our senses of what folk music was, especially urban people, what folk music was. And it led to a group called the New Law City Ramblers, Mike Seeger and John Cohen and Tom Paley, listening to these commercial recordings from the 1930s and 20s and replicating that for audiences around the country. And it was a clarion call to us,
okay,
to do music straight the way it had been done in the 30s, 20s, and by implication older than that. And that there was a joy in that. And I was looking for a good New Law City Ramblers song to play, but I couldn't find it in my collection. It's, you know, all my LPs are in storage.
But you play pretty straight.
You
try to play straight.
I do try to play pretty straight.
You know, I was asking you earlier, you know, about your audience.
Yeah.
You know, and who you're playing to. Because, you know, you're not making these songs into hip hop songs and you're not making them into rock and roll songs. Which leads me to believe that you really enjoy playing straight. And although you say that you're adapting, you're really only adapting up to a point where you're comfortable and you could still bring through the emotion of the music. Is that a fair,
that's fair
assessment?
That's fair. Yeah. So I try to keep in my mind when I'm talking to audiences today what the roots music sounds like. Try to be honest to it, and at the same time realize that people they have to have it interpreted, have to have it framed, and that's the craft.
Now, what about singer-songwriter music? How'd that happen?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think because so much of the old music. I mean, let's look like Joan Baez in 1959 hits the scene at the Newport Folk Festival. Right, Bob Gibson introduces her. There's a purity in that voice, and she's singing about earnest, serious things that seem to go back in time forever. And people love that contemplative view of the world and timelessness. And I think people began to write that way and want to emulate that. And at first, they probably were copying traditional songs, but then it moved till it became the person projecting their own personality through the music, because that's the way you make a living. You know, you got to establish your art as a writer. I get to travel in England a lot, and I get about 8 weeks a year, and I get to see the folk scene there. It's not as heavily singer-songwriter as we are. I mean, they've got their rock, you know, and they've got, yeah, that's fine, so we have our rock. But their folk revival, which is the term, they're people who are interested in folk music, even if they're rocking it, they're using old tunes and old texts, whereas here we tend to be.
Do you think that it's easier for people to be able to relate to something? Like, I'm just going to say the singer-songwriter, they're just talking about generally nebulous emotions and whatever else. They're not talking about whatever. Whereas like a folk song might be talking about driving a railroad spike, and people don't drive railroad spikes now.
You're right. People decide for themselves what their real music is.
What their real music. People decide for themselves.
People decide
what their real...
for themselves, and they will choose. And that makes the market. And it makes, if you want to look at it that way, it makes the folk songs of 100 years from now. Because that community, now it's countrywide in a second, will decide what things survive. We decided the Beatles stuff from the 60s is going to survive.
Yes. Yeah, we have.
We have. There's lots of pop stuff that happened in the 60s that didn't survive.
You have examples of songs that you brought in that are sort of direct correlations between an older type of music and something newer. You're sort of pointing that out to me as we were talking before the show.
Well, okay. Let's play a little bit of Clarence Ashley. There's no way to not play Clarence. He was a Western North Carolina banjo player who had played commercially in the 30s and influenced so many people. Cut number one there.
Hey, great. That's easy. While we're waiting for this to load up, I just need to say that programming on Portsmouth Community Radio is made possible by you, our members, and by the Seacoast Growers Association, presenting farmers markets in the Seacoast region for 32 years with local produce, meats, prepared foods, garden plants, and handcrafted goods. Seacoastgrowers.org. Okay, let's listen to a bit of this music here.
Going to build me log cabin on a mountain so high so I can see Willie as he goes on by. Pretty bird, she wobbles as she flies. She never hollers cuckoo till the 4th of July. Mm-hmm. I've played cards in England. I've played cards in Spain. I'll bet you $10 I beat you next game.
In fate.
Jackie Diamonds, Jackie Diamonds, I've known you from old. This morning to me, give me your key, this rent ain't free. I can't live on nothing, you see. Pack off your clothes and skidoo, you. I've been waiting till my bell comes home. He's my honey from the honeycomb. He said that he'd never leave me alone. It's my horning because it's moving day, moving day. Rip the carpet up off the floor, get on your overcoat and out the door, because it's moving day. Back up your clothes and get away. If you can't pay your rent, gotta live out in a tent, because it's moving day.
All right, that's a pretty clear adaptation of the music, I would say, between the two. Tell me about those two just one more time. I mean, how did one happen to the other, and what was your relationship to those?
So you've got Clarence Ashley, who was the single banjo player there in the beginning, recorded in the 1960s. He played with the Carolina Tar Heels. He was a commercial artist, but a rural person in the 1930s. The Harry Smith anthology brought him out, and it hit a lot of people just before me, you know, the generation of the 50s, as being, whoa, this is great stuff. They hadn't heard this, you know, it was 20, 30 years earlier. And it influenced the New La City Ramblers and a bunch of people like the Holy Modal Rounders, who came out with an album in 1964 of that name, Holy Modal Rounders. And it just knocked our socks off, man. We at college, who were doing this bluesy stuff and listening to old-time banjo, said, yeah, that's it. It's weird and funny and cool and good, and we want it.
And what year did you say that this was
64
happening?
That came
64.
Out.
64. So this is very different than a lot of the music that was being played on the radio. I mean,
amen.
Yeah, and so you're listening to this going, hey, this is the way, this is it.
And if you'll note, it's different from Peter, Paul, and Mary and the Highwaymen and the Brothers Four and whatever it is that the commercial singers were doing called folk music.
I will note that. And that is very important to note, because it shows that there was this sort of thing that was happening, you know, at the time. It wasn't like all of a sudden it was Bob Dylan and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and then that was it, and this other stuff went away. What happened was, it was sort of a schism, I guess you would say. And you know, is that what was going on, or was it more like, I mean, how'd you find this? I mean, okay, when I was a kid, I was listening to rock and roll music, and then somebody came out with and said, oh, you know, you read, it was kind of like Dave Soretti, listening to the rock and roll music, and then he'd find out that it was Robert Johnson that was a big influence on the stuff that he was listening
exactly.
to, and then he went out and got that.
Right.
So is this a similar kind of thing?
Yes, I was listening to Dave talk about that, and I agree with him completely. That's what happened. You hear the pop element of it. I mean, there were people, because of the Kingston Trio, there were people who went and got their PhDs in folklore because they heard the music from the pop singers, and they dug down a little bit deeper to find out where that song came from, fell in love with the old stuff, and turned it into their careers.
Out of curiosity, have you ever heard Bruce Springsteen's album Live in Dublin by any chance?
No, I haven't. Okay. No, I've heard him do the stuff that he did about Seeger and.
Okay, did you hear heard the Seeger stuff?
Mm-hmm.
What do you?
I think great.
Okay.
I think great. I mean, I'm so glad that he's recognizing what Pete has meant to the country and to the music too, and to the banjo especially. I mean, Pete brought the banjo back into popularity.
Pete brought the banjo back into popularity.
Yes, he did. He was at the same time. I might get tongue tied here because it's so interesting. The bluegrass music was beginning to happen after World War II, and I'm not talking about that, the commercial bluegrass music. I'm talking about people playing their own music and using it for folk song, Greenwich Village style in the 50s and later. Pete was the mentor for most of us. I can leave it at that.
Okay, why don't we just leave it at that?
It's too deep.
But let's, okay, because... Yes, we'll definitely do that. I'd like to talk about, you know, you felt like you wanted to do the blues, this and that, but then you came back to what you were calling Anglo folk music.
Yeah.
And I think you brought in something that we're going to play next that's
right
within that line. We're going to where you're headed now, what you're
doing
now.
Big influence on me. In 1967, I got out of the Navy, and I met an English singer named Louis Killen, who came from the northeast of England. Just the finest interpreter of Anglo song that I'd ever heard. Sea songs, ballads. I loved his singing style. It seemed to speak to me directly, and it still does. And I wanted you to hear a little bit of him right now.
Okay, here we go. Louis Killen.
You seamen bold who plow the ocean, see dangers landsmen never know. It's not for honor or promotion, no tongue can tell what they undergo. In the blusterous winds, in the great dark waters, our ship went drifting on the sea, her headgear gone and her rudder broken, which brought us to extremity. For 14 days, heart sore and hungry, seeing but wild water and bitter sky, poor fellows, they fell in a totter, a casting lots as to which should die. The lot it fell on Robert Jackson, whose family was so very great. Oh, I'm free to die, but oh, my comrades, let me keep lookout till the break of day. A full-dressed ship, like the sun a-glitterin', come bearing down to their relief. And as soon as this glad news was shouted, it banished all their cares and grief. The ship brought to, no longer drifting, safe in St. Vincent, Cape Verde she gained. Oh, you seamen bold who hear my story, pray you'll never suffer the like again.
Talk about, in, you know, raw in a lot of ways. Just pure voice.
That's right. I mean, if you want to know how to sing an unaccompanied song, you don't have to go much farther than that. Phrasing, wonderful. I mean, the emotion is there. It's practically like a good actor. You know, he's seeing it. He's seeing the scene.
Now, we're going to be listening to some of your music, some of the music that you've recorded, that you've collected pretty soon. And I would say that when you play this as an influence, it makes me say, oh, yeah, well, it's pretty clear that it is. And, you know, the folk music that we listen to now, that we listen to and play, is a little bit, would you call it on the fringe? I mean, it's not exactly mainstream, so would that make it fringe?
Fringe of what?
Fringe of mainstream, I guess.
I don't even know how to answer that question. I tell you, when the folk revival was going away, that is, you know, in the 80s, when there was not the commercial interest, people were saying to me, aren't you afraid that like all the music's going to die out? And I thought, you know, come on, man. There's this underground current of the songs and the old dance tunes, which continues on and has, Mike Seeger said to me, there's more people playing old-time fiddle now than there ever have been in America.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
So that's not going to go away. It may spike and get commercially viable for a little while and then drop back down, but always that river is going right underneath it, underneath everything. And it influences the pop music, and then it doesn't, but it's always there. So I don't know. What do we do? What do we sing? You mean what you and I sing when we go down the press room? I don't know. I guess it's fringe. It's for 99% of the people have never heard anything like it. You look at the faces of those people who are walking by and hear us sing at the press room of a Friday night, and they'll ask somebody, what band is this? You know, not a band. It's just a gathering of people who want to share some songs.
Like you, I'm always concerned about, now that I've come to the music and this particular type of music, you know, I have concerns about where it's going. But you are right. I mean, apparently country music is more popular than it ever has been.
No worries.
And in a lot of ways, when you hear this other, you know, the number one, do you even know what the number one hit is right now in the United States?
What else you want to talk about?
Yeah. Let's talk about a number one hit that I think is interesting. I was down at a folk festival, and this is how things go on. You know, you start to hear the music, you start to get involved. I was at the folk festival. I heard them sing a song. I recorded a little bit of it. I looked it up online, which you can do now. It's called Dixie Darlin'. I asked you about it, and you said, oh, yeah, not only do I know that song, but I happen to have gone back and looked at the old words and done a few other things and came up with it. It took me 20 years from the time I heard it to actually perform it. Isn't that what you said, basically?
It's rather another child of the Harry Smith anthology. I don't know if he released it. I don't think he did. But it made people go back and listen to the recordings from the 1930s and the 1920s, which in turn, like Charlie Poole and the North Carolina Ramblers, they had done pop songs from 1900. It's just what was ever in their ken. And then they wanted to do it old-timey style. They put it in with banjos and fiddles and stuff and had a great time. So this is a 1908 song, popular Tin Pan Alley, Broadway. I don't mean Broadway show, just being sold as sheet music on Broadway, that got into old-timey hands down in Georgia and North Carolina and came out as a... Way down below the Mason-Dixon line, down where the honeysuckles are entwined, that's where the southern breeze blowing, that's where the daisy growing. Girls of the north in the gay finery, whirling around in the society, singing songs of Dixie darling, that's where I long to be. My Dixie darling, listen to the song I sing beneath the silver moon. With my banjo right in tune, my heart is ever true. I love no one but you, my Dixie darling, my Dixie queen. Girls in the north in the gay finery, whirling around in the society, somehow to me never seems so appealing. Over me there comes feeling. That's where the girls fill my heart with delight. Banjos and tune in the moon shining bright. Singing songs of Dixie darling. That's where I long to be. My Dixie darling. Listen to the song I sing beneath the silver moon. With the banjo right in tune. My heart is ever true. I love no one but you, my Dixie darling. My Dixie queen. So you have a song from 1908, pop, piano playing, sheet music sales, picked up by a 1930s band, then reproduced. And I heard it in the 80s from the Highwood String Band, who I love in the 70s, from the Highwood String Band, who, again, were listening to old-time 30s recordings and trying to replicate that sound. They sang, and I said, I love that. 20 years later, I finally learned it, and the words were weird. I think they were weird because the Carter family had recorded it in the 1920s or the 1930s and had just picked what they wanted from the text. which was kind of 1900-ish text. And so, yeah, so I went back to the original sheet music because now with the web, we can do that. And I found the text and I integrated them. I see no problem with that. I integrated them to make it make sense for me. And for me, that's what my job is, to take that old music, make it sensible first to myself and then with luck to an audience.
Well, that makes sense to me, too. That was great. That was a lot of fun listening to you perform that. And I don't know, talk about keeping it real. Well, that was about as real as it gets. Except I didn't want to mention to everybody that we actually built a stage for Jeff, and he's about 10 feet above me right now with lights, big lights, big bright lights. Hey, you're listening to Local Folk, and we have about, just a couple seconds left, really. But if you all have interest in this music and want to learn more, Jeff Warner and what you've heard and him and what he does now, the education that he provides for people and the telling of the stories, a lot of it you can get through his CDs, and there's a lot of information in there. But you could start at his website, jeffwarner.com. I think that's a great place to start.
Yep.
Also, you can come on down to the press room on a Friday night and give it a listen. Jeff's not always there, but people are there, and they're helping this music happen and move along. Do you do a lot of when's your next public gig?
Mystic Seaport at the Music Festival.
Oh, that's coming up really soon.
It's 2 weeks. Yes, they have for almost 30 years there. Having people come from all over the country who are interested in old sea songs, and it's quite a lovely place.
Now, we're going to have to go in just a minute. I want people to see what you're doing, but I also we were talking a little bit before the show about another correlation that that you were making between music that you've heard, and this time it's music that you've performed, and maybe we can even play a bit of that, and then maybe we can go out with an adaptation or a correlation at least. Tell me about that.
I admired what my folks were doing and going into rural America to find songs. I went with them as a child and then as an adult with them. Got to meet Alan Lomax, who was a champion of my folks, who did a massive collection. Unbelievable. It now belongs to the Library of Congress. And one of the people that Alan Lomax collected in Grassy Creek, North Carolina, first in the 30s and then again in the 70s, am I right? No, in the 50s, was a man named Estill C. Ball, E.C. Ball, who was a fine gospel singer and guitar player. And he has inspired me. So I thought what we'd do here, play a little bit of E.C. Ball and his wife, Orna, from Grassy Creek, North Carolina, recorded in the 50s, saying, "I see God in everything," and then pick it up with my and Barbara Ben's interpretation of an E.C. and Orna Ball song called "Give Me Just a Little More Time."
That's excellent. And this is how the tradition continues, more than any other way, I would say.
I like it.
Very good. Hey, looks like Under the Radar is not going to be on next. So we're going to put on some recorded music. But please go to jeffwarner.com, check that out. Also, if you have any questions for me, skerrigan at wscafm.org. You can listen to this. You can find me online at stephencarrigan.com. There's a tab for Local Folk. You can get all of the older episodes if you want to get involved. You can find me on Facebook if you look up Stephen Carrigan's Local Folk Music Show. So there's a lot of ways to get listening and get involved and get thinking about folk music and how the music affects you and what you can possibly do it. We're going to listen to E.C. Ball, and that was track, I'm sorry, one more time, Jeff?
9.
All right. And next week we have Tony Giblin, who is
good singer.
He's not only a good singer, he has provided an environment where this type of music can prosper as well in his time. He's also somebody who went from being an engineer to somebody who came to the music
well.
So, yes, last week I had Regina Delaney, who was an engineer and a nurse.
Right.
And came to the music, and here's another engineer. I don't know how it all works, but hey, folks, here on Local Folk, you come on down, you come to the music as well. This is Steve Carrigan, and I wish you the best.
When I stand and watch There's not a doubt the time is running out and my hardest time is drawing nigh. I need a little time to gather in the green before we leave this world behind. I'm ready when you call me, but give me just a little more time. Give me just a little more time, Lord, give me just a little more time. So many precious souls are lost in sin, so many, many left behind. Got a lot of things I'd like to do before we leave this world behind. I'm ready when you call me, but give me just a little more time. I need a little time to listen to my Lord before the final judgment day. I need a little time to preach the word of God and to serve man along life's way. Every moment that I have to tarry in this world to try to make my laughter shine. I'm ready when you call me, but give me just a little more time. Give me just a little more time, Lord, give me just a little more time. So many precious souls are lost in sin, so many, many left behind. I got a lot of things I'd like to do before I leave this world behind. I'm ready when you call me, but give me just a little more time. Give me just a little more time, Lord, give me just a little more time. So many precious souls are lost in sin, so many, many left behind. I got a lot of things I'd like to do before I leave this world behind. I'm ready when you call me, but
give me just a little more time.